This is WDET, your source for news, music, and culture in Detroit. Please protect your source for on-demand programs, podcasts, and radio programs that you can experience whenever and wherever you choose. Make a gift today at WDET.org.
Hi, I'm Andalisi. Welcome to Essential Conversations. In this episode, I talk with journalist, actor, and humorist Mo Rocca. Back in 1998, he was a Daily Show correspondent and went on to be a judge on Iron Chef America, a panelist on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and host of Innovation Nation at the Henry Ford. Speaking to the Henry Ford, it was there that I caught up with him for our conversation. We sat on a stage in an empty auditorium for an absolutely delightful chat. So I'm here talking with Mo Rocca. We are big fans, of course.
Thank you very much.
Being at public radio. As a matter of fact, you're a hard act to follow because Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is always on before my show, but at least it's a good lead-in for me.
Well, you know, I feel guilty because I've done Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, gosh, I guess for 14 years, and I travel so much for my main job at CBS Sunday Morning that I've been doing Wait, Wait less frequently. So whenever people stop me, and I'm very flattered that they say, oh, I love you on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, I feel also like a little twinge of guilt for not doing it more often. But anyway.
How did you get that gig? Like, you have so many different facets of your career.
There's Adam Felber, who is a brilliant panelist and also a writer-producer for Bill Maher, recommended me. So I owe him complete thanks for being on that show.
Do you know what the subject of the show is? Do you guys have any idea when you're going to go in? I mean, it sounds very impromptu, and I know that sometimes things do, and then there are jokes that are written, but it sounds like you guys don't know.
So I always say that whatever you think is written is actually written, in that obviously the questions and the tags, those usually very hilarious sort of kind of answers and little explanations that Peter has afterwards are obviously scripted in by Peter and the producers. All the reactions from the panelists are impromptu, the bluffs, though, we do write on our own. I feel very protective of that, pointing that out, that they're not just given to us to read. We actually write them on our own. And the real story, for people who know the show, is actually the hardest to write because you're bound by fact.
Right.
So you have to try to make it sound as ridiculous as possible without lying. The other two bluffers get to just make stuff up. But I've learned a lot doing the show, and in that if you come in armed with the best joke in the world, it usually doesn't work. And I think because, this is going to sound very NPR-ish, it violates the contract with the audience. I think the audience that is listening thinks this is a group of people getting together and off the cuff, you know, bantering and making jokes. And if you go in there and you think, I've got the best joke and I'm going to drop it at just the right point, usually doesn't work, because I think the audience subconsciously realizes, that's canned. That's not the rules of the game, where you guys are just supposed to be thinking of stuff off the top of your head. So it ends up becoming a job where the best way to prepare is really not to be prepared. It's just to kind of read up on the news and just really trust that spontaneous conversation will work best.
That's very interesting. So let's talk about your life as a writer. In that you've written in very different ways, and you've written for children, and you've written for adults. And I wonder if the approach is the same, or you get into a different mind space when you know you're writing to get to kids.
So I thank you for asking that question, because the most important professional experience and creative experience I had that I keep going back to was writing for a PBS kids show called Wishbone. And it was a friend of mine came up with the idea of the show, a woman named Stephanie Simpson, and I didn't realize it at the time. I was in my 20s, but it was kind of an idyllic creative experience, because really what our job was, for people not familiar with the show, and is to take classic novels, mostly from the Western canon, and boil them down to 30-minute stories starring a dog. So it was basically retelling classic stories through the eyes of a Jack Russell Terrier. It was live action, very lavishly produced in a suburb of Dallas, Texas. And it was writing boot camp, because what it meant was I, as a writer, had to take some of the greatest stories ever told and tease out a thread from there that would work as a 30-minute story targeted to a 6 to 11-year-old. And one thing we did was we didn't write for children in a goo-goo-goo-goo-gaga way, because that never worked. And in fact, people that write in children's TV, when they say, well, I know what my daughter will like,
right,
they're usually wrong. It's off, you know, I mean, it's interesting to note that Theodore Geisel, Dr. Seuss, had no children. And I think in a weird way that might have helped him, because he wasn't doing the goo-goo-goo-goo-gaga baby talk kind of writing. But one of the great things about writing for kids is that kids can sniff out when you're just marking time, when you're just filling space. They demand constant action, and that's really what storytelling should be. It should be dynamic, and action should constantly be moving forward. You shouldn't just fill in space with people yapping about whatever. So I learned, learned this well and put it into practice. I learned to write sort of economically and to tell a story that was constantly moving forward, which I think is really important.
So that was how you got in at The Daily Show, was as a writer, right?
Well, that's how I applied. I was very shrewd, I think, in getting on to TV, because making the leap from writing to being on camera was tricky. And for The Daily Show, Jon Stewart was, I mean, it's not an exaggeration to say he was a visionary, what he turned that show into. In fact, I oftentimes think he was more talented at sort of creating a show than an actual performance.
Right.
And he was generally playing the straight man in those bits of the correspondence anyway. But there are a zillion people that could go and pretend to be a reporter. That part of the performance wasn't hard, but what got me onto camera is that I came armed with stories. I'm a big American history buff, and I'd been all over the country visiting the homes and grave sites of obscure presidents, and I was finding really good stories. And during the Clinton impeachment crisis in 97-98, I went to Greenville, Tennessee, to the hometown of Andrew Johnson, the first impeached president, all with an eye towards pitching The Daily Show on a story about how do you memorialize an impeached president 100 years or so after the fact. And it was kind of a quirky town, lovely town, actually, lovely area of eastern Tennessee. And they had, like, the Andrew Johnson Motor and the Andrew Johnson Laundromat, the Andrew Johnson everything. So it was an offbeat story, but I was hired as much for my ability as a performer as I was for bringing stories with me.
So let's talk about your fascination with presidents, and that you started to visit all of these different places.
Yeah.
What president have we missed the mark on in terms of how good they really were?
Well, I'm actually doing for CBS Sunday Morning a story on one which is Herbert Hoover, because Herbert Hoover, in as much as anyone remembers him at all, you think the shorthand on him is the guy who either caused the Depression or just sort of let it happen and was a big failure. And back before he was president, his moniker was the Great Humanitarian. I mean, it's inarguable that he saved millions of people from starvation during World War I. He was not an easy guy. The temptation is to say, in fact, he was a saint. No, he was. Woodrow Wilson hired him to be its food administrator when people were starving in Belgium and across Europe, and when America really needed to conserve its own food resources. And he was a bull in a china cabinet. I mean, he was somebody who, before Congress even approved his appointment, rushed in and started ordering people around. But you know what? For all those people on both sides of the aisle who are sick of government not moving, that's okay with me. If I were back there, I would have said, it's fine with me, because he was an organizational genius. I mean, he was able to get different parts of government to work together very quickly and efficiently, and saved millions of people. I mean, and now he was an ardent laissez-faire proponent, and so that did not serve the country well after the stock market crashed. But key elements of what FDR implemented came from Herbert Hoover. So, by the end of Hoover's administration, you know, he'd lost the faith of the people in the Congress.
Which president that you can recall, that given how much you know about them, would be a president that would be good for today?
It's a great question. You know, people seem frustrated with things not getting done, which is obviously frustration as much or if not more with Congress. James K. Polk was somebody who sort of famously came in saying, I'm going to do these four things, and did them all. Now, apparently he was a bald-faced liar, that he could really look you straight in the eye and just totally lie to you. But is that what we want? Is that something, not the lying part necessarily, but the getting things done? You know, I'm an Eisenhower fan. Eisenhower, like Hoover, people don't remember this, was somebody who never allied himself with a party until the very last minute. He sort of transcended that and warned about the military-industrial complex. So I think his stock has risen through the years. But who would do well in this climate? Maybe somebody like him he was a Supreme Allied Commander. He defeated Hitler. So maybe it would require somebody like that to make everybody come on board. Or most people.
Very interesting. So let's talk about one of the things I wanted to ask you, and this is really recent, is the notion of fake news. But now we take it to Facebook, for instance, and the question is, how much did those fake news stories have an impact on the election? How should they be accountable for allowing these quote-unquote news stories to be out there when they're not true? What do you think about all that?
Well, I mean, I definitely think it's a good thing that Mark Zuckerberg sort of turned around, backpedaled and said, okay, he all but said it is Facebook's responsibility to at least try. It's going to be very difficult with almost a couple billion users, but it's to try to weed out the fake news. I can't say. I mean, if we learned anything from this election is that nobody knows anything. So I can't – it's hard to say how much of a role that played. But, you know, I'm not trying to sidestep your question here. I mean, look, for people who are really unhappy with what happened with the election, one silver lining may be, and it's really the only solution, I think, is an engaged electorate, is people who subscribe to newspapers and really try to keep informed with what's happening. But, you know, I get that it's difficult. I get that people tune into elections usually still, even after this very sort of colorful election, at the last minute. Because, you know, if you're somebody with a full-time job and three kids, I mean, you only got so much the word of the year bandwidth, right? And whenever I hear about fake news, I do kind of laugh because Jon Stewart used to say about The Daily Show with a wink, we're a fake news show.
Right.
And look, I think part of that was that, John, like any comic, you don't want to seem self-important because then it gets really unfunny quickly. Like Letterman, who I think was obviously a masterful interviewer, and some of the interviews through his years were, I do think, made a big impression on people, would always sort of mock himself. And John did that too. I have to say, though, I do wonder if John had still been hosting The Daily Show, because one of the things that happened with Donald Trump, and Donald Trump was right about this when he got angry at CNN and said, you guys are just making these longer debates because you can make more money. And he was right about that a three-hour debate was more profitable than a two-hour debate. But everyone, to some extent, needed Donald Trump to come back on their air because of the ratings. And that's sort of that's a really unhealthy codependency, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that John has the integrity that if he had had Donald Trump on his show, he would have interviewed him not caring whether Donald Trump ever came back. And I think everyone else pulled their punches a little bit because he was ratings gold. And I think he knew that. So there was always a little bit of, I don't want to really get too into it because I might not get him back. I think that.
It's very interesting.
And I don't think John would have done that.
So we're in Detroit. We're at the Henry Ford, which is absolutely beautiful. And you're here for Innovation Nation, talking about people who innovate, which is amazing. Tell me about a story that has stuck with you in terms of an innovator. And we're surrounded by them. And the fact that you're celebrating them is very exciting because we celebrate sometimes the wrong things. people that can change the world. You're talking about people who can potentially do that. Is there any one particular story that sticks with you?
Well, one story that really has stuck with me that's from the museum itself is about Igor Sikorsky and the development of the invention of the helicopter. He's a poor kid in Russia, and he reads a Jules Verne novel, and I feel terrible because I'm forgetting which one it is. And Jules Verne describes what is essentially a helicopter before it's ever been invented, this fantastical sort of single propeller, I guess a double propeller, but single on the top, propeller-driven aerial transport. And I love that story for that reason, because he's inspired by imagination, by a work of fiction. But he dreams big, as we say at the end of the show, but we also say don't quit. Dream big and don't quit. And Igor Sikorsky, this takes decades. He comes to America, and he keeps working on this thing. And he works in aeronautics, but it takes, what, 4 decades, I think, for a prototype. And I think it's just wonderful because the number of failures in those decades that lead to this huge success, I think, are really what the show is about, which is that, you know, hashtag fail, the way that people abuse each other on the internet. I mean, failure, no one likes to fail. And fail is not a favorite word of mine, as familiar as I am with it. But it is part of success. And you have to, I mean, not just in technology, but and certainly in any kind of creative endeavor, you have to be willing to fail and not be afraid of that, or you'll never succeed.
Coming up next, I turn the tables on Mo Rocca. Hi, I'm Ann DeLisi with the conclusion of my conversation with Mo Rocca.
Can you recall one of your best failures in terms of a fail that taught you an enormous lesson?
I'm still learning. I did a TV show when I was sort of leaving The Daily Show based on the Smoking Gun website. And the guys who put the Smoking Gun, I'll forever respect them because they were real old-fashioned shoe leather reporters, really did the work. And I had an opportunity. I was asked to host a show that based on the website. And it probably wasn't the right fit for me anyway, but it was a disaster for a bunch of different reasons. And I still feel badly about the actual creators of the website because they had faith in me and they, you know, work hard and are very good at what they do. And I'm still trying to learn from that. I remember at the time thinking this is humiliating and this hurts. And I hope this is thickening my skin in a certain way. You know, it's funny. That's something that I'm still trying to like. I want to believe that helped me in the future. But anyway, I mean, I think that the from my failures, at the very least, what I've learned is they don't kill you, and maybe to not treat things as so high stakes, every individual thing, so that it can roll off your back and you can move on to the next thing.
You must have a lot of people approaching you all the time to do any number of things because you're multi-talented. And I wonder how you vet those things.
Well, I try to, at this stage, I'm 47 now, so what I try to do is separate what I should do from what I want to do. So when people say, here's an idea, and I'm not excited by it, and then they say, but you should do it, because this will lead to that. I'm not doing that anymore. I think that's more appropriate when you're in your 20s and 30s.
Right.
Like do X to get to Y. You know, A and B will lead to C. I think that's great and that's important. And early on, you should try a lot of different things if you don't know exactly what you want to build those muscles. But I'm trying to really only do things that excite me. And you know it. I think you know it. I think you know it in relationships, and I think you know it professionally as well. What's truly exciting to you? So, I had a cooking show for 4 seasons that lasted for 4 seasons, and it was truly an endeavor of passion. I created the show, I hosted it, and I put everything into it, and I just loved it. And that's
you could
the
tell
feel-
you loved it.
Well, you know, it's funny. I interviewed Melissa McCarthy. I was doing a profiling her for CBS Sunday Morning. And while we were setting up the camera, she asked, she goes, oh, you're doing this cooking show where you cook with grandmothers across the country. And I said, yeah. And she goes, I can tell you really love it. And I was, first of all, flattered that she knew about it at all, but that she picked up on that. And I think you, and it's a, there's a big lesson
in
that.
Tell.
You can just tell when somebody is really engaged.
Well, let's talk about that show because it's funny, it's fun, it's engaging. And when you're dealing with grandmothers and grandfathers, the funniest thing about them is they don't have any need for much of a filter by then.
Yeah.
And you are so good at fielding that attitude, and you roll with it so well with them because some of them just tell you like it is. Your one of my favorite ones was the people that lived in Intercourse. What state that?
The Nepali, Meena and Amar, they live near Intercourse, Pennsylvania. they actually live in, not Nazareth, they live right outside of Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Really wonderful people. There are a lot of Nepalis who
it
knew.
It was hilarious.
In Amish country there. And one of my favorites was Clyda Ellison, who mm-hmm. lives in Palmer Woods,
yes,
Detroit.
In Detroit, yeah.
And her son is Keith Ellison, mm-hmm. who is still in the running for DNC chair to replace W. Wasserman Schultz. He's in Minnesota. He's, I guess, one of only two Muslim members of Congress, although mm-hmm. Clyda is a pretty devout Catholic, and all the boys went to a Jesuit high school in Detroit, and I can't remember the name. But I loved her. I think she was such a smart, wise, elegant woman, and her husband, who was a psychiatrist, had a stroke, a really severe stroke, and she's taken care of him at home for decades now. She also is obviously a fantastic cook from Natchitoches down in Louisiana, so Creole cooking. And it was just kind of great hearing her, and she's not maudlin about it at all, talking about the choice that she made mm-hmm. to have her husband at home and take care of him. And so these were just great. I mean, she, like all the other, most all the other grandparents I met on the show, and I would go to their homes and cook with them, learn to cook in their kitchens. They are at a place in their lives where things have crystallized, and they care about two or three things, and they know what those things are. And as the kids say, they own them, and it's very inspiring for, you know, for somebody like me who still worries too much about what other people think. It's very fortifying to be with people who only care what a couple of people think, the people that really matter. Not, you know, and it's yeah, it was just a wonderful experience.
It was a brilliant idea, and I in particular loved when you talked with Lydia Bastianich. She was so charming.
Yeah, she's great.
And she really told you like it is, which was funny.
Yeah, Lydia Bastianich, I did a little thing that's on YouTube, which was essentially not the pilot of my cooking show, which is called My Grandmother's Ravioli, but I sort of tested out the idea with her. And so we actually made My Grandmother's Ravioli, which was fantastic, and Lydia's a master.
Yeah, so. She is. That was really fun to watch. I was on your Twitter feed, which is great fun to watch. There was a lot of baseball, so I figured, oh, he must really love baseball. And then I saw your photos from the Al Smith dinner.
Yeah.
And I thought, what is that like to attend that dinner?
So the Al Smith dinner, I sit on the board of an inner city Catholic schools charity in New York. So every 4 years, the dinner is every year, the Al Smith dinner in New York. But every 4 years when there's a presidential election, it's a command performance. The candidates show up and have to do a comedy routine. First of all, the dinner is, for that kind of a thing, the best there is. I wouldn't miss it for the world. It's just Al Smith IV, the great-grandson, I guess, of Al Smith, who ran for president in 1928, the first Catholic to run. And he ran against Herbert Hoover, actually, as a Democrat. His great-grandson is hilarious. There's no fat. It's a very lean dinner in that everybody speaking is entertaining and mm-hmm. worth listening to. when it was in 2008, Barack Obama and John McCain, it was very, very funny. McCain was hilarious because I think to be funny in a situation like that, you got to be a little bit mean. You got to be willing to really go for it. And interestingly enough, Hillary Clinton was at that dinner. She had, of course, lost in the primary battle with Barack Obama. And you could tell that Hillary loved John McCain. I have it on good authority that they actually really do love each other. And she was laughing far more at John McCain's hits on Barack Obama than vice versa. And Barack Obama was a little bit the then senator was a little bit too cool for the room. In 2012, he was very, as President Obama, he was very, very funny. And Mitt Romney was funny in that kind of stiff guy, cracking jokes like the Al Gore kind of.
He was a little self-deprecating too at that point. He did well.
Yeah, this dinner was kind of fascinating and a little unsettling because Donald Trump, Hillary wasn't particularly funny, but she was funnier than I expected, but Donald Trump got really mean, and that was a room that could have been on his side. And it was interesting to see them turn because he sort of violated the rule of the dinner, which is if you're going to be mean, you better be funny.
Okay, so I'm going to take a page out of your book, and we're going to go through a number of things, and you have to tell me this or that. Stick shift or automatic?
A stick shift. I feel sexier.
White meat or dark meat?
Dark meat, definitely. There's nothing worse than like dry chicken. I mean, there are worse things. A tsunami is worse than that. But but it's very difficult to find white meat that's like tender. And I know women hate this word, moist throughout. Dark meat, it's just better.
Ice skates or rollerblades?
Ice skates. I was a roller skating waiter as my first job out of college at a French restaurant in Washington, D.C. called La Niçoise. And rollerblades had just come in, and it was just annoying. And also, you can carry French onion soup and not spill it much easier with old-fashioned roller skates because you're basically just, like, clomping along.
Yeah. White potatoes or sweet potatoes?
It's interesting. When I go to the ready-made section in my supermarket, they offer both. And, you know, sweet potatoes, I feel like they're a little like Honey Nut Cheerios. Like, oh, I'm still, you know, it's a sweeter way of getting something that's sort of healthy-ish, but mashed potatoes are better with gravy.
Taking a shower or taking a bath?
Well, the problem is that I'm always tired, I think, and when I sort of like slip into a bath in a hotel, my muscles relax so instantly that I'm in danger of drowning. Like, I think I'm always – I really do. I really think, like, I'm going to drown because this is so relaxing and I'm just going to submerge completely. So I think I just need to sleep 10 hours and then take a bath.
Taco Bell or McDonald's?
I love McDonald's. Maybe they put crack in the food. There's something in there that you just – it's evil what they do. But I love – a filet of fish, or my mother, who's Colombian, goes, "Ay, fish filet," and by the way, the filet of fish—I think they used to call it. Maybe it is now just a fish filet. Anyway, but there are so many calories; it's crazy. It's just a slather on that. It's like that it has the consistency of that hollandaise sauce, which is like the devil's secretion. Like it's just so highly caloric; it's crazy. But it's delicious, and those fries, russet burlap.
Acoustic guitar or electric guitar?
Acoustic, because I once, when I met George Jones, the great George Jones, he gave me his breakfast sausage, and that's not a euphemism. It was, and he said it was for a short while. He had a breakfast sausage, and the motto was "All pork and no possum." All pork and no possum. And so then I was doing bits for the Today Show, and I went on when Katie Kirk was the host, and I pulled out George Jones's breakfast sausage, and I held it up, and I went, "All pork and no possum." And George Jones, and I wasn't doing it to get anything out of George Jones. I just thought it would be funny. And George Jones sent me a Martin's guitar, which is really great, autographed by him. And I don't know how to play, but I eventually will learn. But I know, like, now someone's going to break into my apartment and find out where I live because it's, like, a very big deal that I have this.
Gas stove or electric?
Gas stove always reminds me of my grandmother. I love that. But I also, it does make you paranoid because you're like, do I smell something? And then, I hope, like, I don't accidentally spark something because this whole place is blowing up.
Burger or cheeseburger?
A bacon cheeseburger.
Coffee or tea?
Coffee.
Dogs or cats?
I like a feline cat. I like a cat that's affectionate and will need my bladder, as in K-N-E-A-D. Like, you know, when you're lying on the couch and the cat, I don't know why cats like to need your bladder, like to go in. And I love that. I love that. And, you know, they're not needy.
Whole milk or 2%?
They're needy, but not needy. 2%. And here's the thing. I had 4 seasons of a cooking show, hosted Foodography, another cooking show for 3 seasons, was a judge on 10 episodes of Iron Chef. I only learned last year what half and half was. I always thought that half and half and cream were the same thing. Because people, I'd say, like, they go, like, half and half or cream? And I go, yes. And then I finally realized that half and half, I just thought half and half was like a brand name. Half and half means half cream and half milk. It wouldn't be half, half and half, because that would then be like,
it doesn't work.
Or something. Okay.
Ice cream or gelato?
Ice cream.
Ketchup, cold or room temperature?
Ketchup, first of
ketchup.
All.
Ketchup, cold or room
kick
temperature?
Kick it all stuff. room temperature.
Toilet tissue, over or under?
Over. I just think it just looks much nicer.
Over easy, scrambled, over medium, poached, over hard, basted, hard boiled, soft boiled, or sunny side up?
Over easy, huevos rancheros.
Electoral college or popular vote?
I think popular vote. I think, you know, I did a documentary on this, and it called Electoral Dysfunction 2012. The argument that the Electoral College forces you to go all over the country, it's just not true. It's not true because the popular vote's always going to be close enough. The candidates will be forced to go to places like North Dakota to try to pick up those extra votes. So I don't believe that they would just campaign in major metropolitan areas. And you can't ignore the basis, the role of slavery in the creation of the Electoral College and the Senate for that matter.
Okay, one final thing.
I do think that gerrymandering is a, and both parties are at fault, are a cancer on our democracy.
I do a music show. Any particular songs that come to mind quickly that you love?
Well, 2 nights ago I met Barbara Streisand, which was just kind of crazy and amazing because I love her. And her concert was fantastic, and it may very well be the last time that she performs in public. It was in Miami, and I met her afterwards, and I think she might have thought I was a dud, which is keeping me awake and will not stop keeping me awake. But, I mean, I wasn't going to gush because I knew enough to know that she doesn't like people to gush, and so I just sort of stood there catatonic-like and didn't really say anything. And then she asked me about the Pennsylvania recount. Because, of course, she's Barbara Streisand, she's very political, and I didn't know what to say because I knew nothing about it. And I said, I think there was a deadline. Now, I know there was a deadline. I'm like, sorry, I'm not going to – no. And so all I can say is even though she may think I'm a dud, I'm still just, like, totally honored and excited to have met her.
My thanks to Mo Rocca for talking with me. The Essential Conversations series is a production of Detroit's public radio station, WDET. If you enjoyed it, I hope you'll listen to other episodes in this series. Production provided by Rowan Nemisto and original music by Brett Lucas. I'm Ann DeLisi. Thanks so much for listening.